For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up in this week's episode, Anita Frank discusses her new novel, The Return, and reflects on the changing landscape on the home front during World War II. After the success of The Tower on TV, I discuss where the series goes next with its author, Kate London. And we meet Diane of Audio Description, Di Langford, and explore her history as a Talking Books narrator. That's all coming up on today's Read On. The Return is Anita Frank's eagerly anticipated follow-up to her debut novel, The Lost Ones. Set just before and after the Second World War on a farm in Berkshire, it gives a fascinating insight into life on the home front for those who worked so hard to keep the nation fed. Anita joined me to tell me more. Anita, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those who haven't yet downloaded The Return from the RNIB Talking Books Library, could you just give us a flavour of the book?
Yeah, of course. Well, in a nutshell, The Return is a love story set around the Second World War. So when Jack joins up in 1939, he makes the rather unusual promise to his pregnant wife, Gwen, that come what may, he will not return. But that becomes a promise Jack is unable to keep. In the meantime, Gwen establishes a good life for herself and their young son, Tom, on the family farm. But the end of the war triggers a chain of events that sees the past come back to haunt Gwen. And her only hope of averting looming tragedy is to enlist the help of the one man she had hoped to never see again. And so Jack and Gwen are thrust together to face their greatest battle yet. And for reasons which will become clear when you listen, it's a fight that neither of them can afford to lose.
Well, from the very beginning, when we are first introduced to Jack in 1939, before the war, we can see that he's a fugitive from something. He has been brought up in the Newcastle shipyards, but for reasons we will discover during the book, he's had to do a runner down to Berkshire.
That's right, yes. So from the beginning, we find that Jack is in alien territory. He is on the run, and by pure chance, he finds himself able to step in and help Gwen, and as a result, is actually taken on as a labourer on the family farm that she lives on with her father, Jim.
It's a rather wonderful Mr. Darcy moment, that, actually, isn't it? Gwen... Gwen's horse is spooked, and she is thrown, and Jack is there as the tall, handsome stranger to step in and save her.
That's right. He's in the right place at the right time. And Jack is by nature a very kind and considerate individual. And so he can't leave a damsel in distress. He does have to step in and save the day. Anybody who's been on horseback knows it can be quite perilous in those situations. So he sees the danger and immediately tries to protect Gwen from any harm. And it's a good job that he does, because obviously that is the catalyst to them meeting and for the story.
I was struck reading the book that we see modern mechanical contraptions coming in and causing harm to the characters. The accident with Gwen's horse is caused by a speeding lorry, or meaning that they don't get the messages that they might otherwise receive. Right at the very beginning of the book, in 1945, Gwen is on board her tractor and she can't hear that the victory bells are being rung, and she might otherwise miss this momentous event. And we also see the plight of the Shire horses, what happens to them during the war, and the fact that they've been replaced after the war. Mechanical inventions seem to be at odds with the humans that they're meant to be serving.
I think this period of history is quite interesting. And I think obviously during the war, Britain needed to feed itself. So it's a time of great change in our farming practices. And certainly before the war, as now, we imported a huge amount of food, and our farming practices had not actually changed a huge amount from the Victorian times. So you do see these wonderful shire horses still dragging the ploughs, still working the reaper binders and so on. And obviously, during the war, the nation needed to be able to feed itself, and we needed to become much more efficient at creating crops and increasing the amount of farmed land that was here available to us in the country. And so that's why we see tractors being brought in. It's an efficiency drive. The horses are a lovely way of life, but they can't get a field ploughed in the time that tractors do. And so there is this mechanical shift in farming, especially during the Second World War. And that's what we see as the book goes on, that yes, in 1939, it is kind of all idyllic with these bucolic scenes that are created. And by the end of the war, that sort of innocence that you see in the countryside is beginning to be lost. And we are seeing the tractors, we see the steam engines fueling the threshing machines. And there are inherent dangers, as you rightly say, with mechanics rather than horses, which can still be dangerous. But obviously, tractors and steam engines, they all hold their own dangers. But it's all to reflect that sort of changing period that occurred and those massive changes in farming that occurred over the Second World War.
And of course, it was the home front and particularly the farms that kept the population of Britain fed and in the war for those 6 years. And Gwen running her family farm with very little help is part of that war effort.
Absolutely. I mean, because obviously we're an island nation, it was very easy for the Germans to blockade us. So that's why we lost an awful lot of our imports during the war, is simply there were ships carrying food that were blown up by the Germans that just simply didn't reach these shores. And that in itself was a treacherous venture, trying to get food from America and Australia and the colonies, trying to get that food to the shores safely was a huge venture and very fraught. So, as I say, we really needed to up our own food production in this country. And absolutely, without the input of the farming community, but also those wonderful women of the Women's Land Army, who were girls from all sorts of walks of life, who answered the call and rocked up at farms and suddenly took on a whole new skill set. And back then, you hadn't got the machinery to make life easier. It really was hard graft in all weathers, doing very strenuous manual labour to get the country fed and, as you rightly say, to keep it in the war.
Now, we meet one of those Land Army girls in the book, Nora, but she isn't just a two-dimensional, ruddy-faced angel. She's a bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah, Nora is a city girl. We know she's from London. We know she's absolutely at home in the bright lights of the city. But she has answered the call and she has joined the Women's Land Army and finds herself helping Gwen on the farm. But she is a very spirited young woman who's got her own agenda and who is determined to live life to the fullest. And nothing's going to stop her. And yeah, she's a key character, obviously, in the book for things that she is responsible for, shall we say.
Indeed. Now, we've mentioned the change that took place for farming in Britain during those years. The impact on individuals at home is really brought home by Gwen and Jack's son, Tom, who we discover very early on has never known peace. He's never known his father. And the end of the war brings an enormous change for him.
Yeah, and actually, the whole idea for this book started from a documentary that I saw years and years ago, long before I started writing, which was looking at the end of the war period and the impact that the returning servicemen had on their families when they came home. And they were returning to wives who, through necessity in their absence, had become self-sufficient, and they were returning to children who often didn't know them. They were complete strangers. And it was watching that documentary that I realized that was an aspect of the war and an impact of the men's service that I hadn't really considered. And it struck me that was a really lovely topic for a story, that here was a man who is returning from fighting for his country, and he needs to fight his way back into his family because they have moved on. It's a long time to be away, and people develop different skills and different ways of doing things when there isn't a man about the house to do it for you. You have to get on and do it yourself. And to come back into that environment where you've got a very independent wife, where you've got a child that doesn't know you, must have been incredibly difficult and also emotionally challenging, I would have thought, for these men to come back, because I'm sure they had sort of blissful ideas of what it would be like to finally have peace and return to that sort of warm embrace of the family. But the family has moved on in their absence. So I always thought that was an interesting challenge for a character to have to face, to, as I say, try and almost battle his way back into the affections of his loved ones.
Is that why you decided to tell the story in two different times, 1939 and 1945, which do coalesce later in the book? But was that to show the distinct before and after?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the events that occur in 1939 lie behind what then goes on to happen in 1945. But yes, I did want to show that, you know, certainly I think Gwen progresses an awful lot from when we see her as a very naive young woman in 1939 to the more sort of hardened and world-weary and experienced woman that she is in 1945. She really does change, I think, throughout those two narratives. And yeah, I did want to reflect the challenges that, you know, we went into war expecting one thing and came out of it not always having what we thought we would have at the end of it. So I thought it was just interesting to have, rather than focusing on events in the war itself, and I should point out that there aren't many scenes that are actually in the actual conflict. It is that before and it is that after which are looked at in the novel.
And actually, in a book that is full of wonderful characters, one of the major protagonists is the countryside around them. There is a deep sense of the resilience and ability to regenerate of the land that surrounds Gwen's farm.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very proud to be a farmer's daughter. So I have a deep-seated love of the countryside. And in part, I did want the book to be almost like an homage to that beautiful countryside around us and to the farming way of life. And I wanted to try and evoke the setting as strongly and as faithfully as I could. And as I say, being a farmer's daughter, I was very lucky not only to be able to draw on my own memories and experiences, but more importantly, to be able to tap into my dad's. My dad was actually born before the war, so he has firsthand experience of a lot of the machinery and farming practices that I describe within the book. And it was just really special being able to turn to him and ask him advice and questions. And we went round the Museum of Rural English Life together in Reading, and he was able to sort of show me a reaper binder and describe in great detail how it works and things like that. So I really did want to try and faithfully recreate that countryside setting that would have been in existence around those war years.
The audiobook version has been brought brilliantly to life by Katie Sobey, who clearly relished having different accents to cope with. I was wondering, did you have anything to do with her selection as a narrator?
Yeah, from the beginning, I felt it was very important that we had an actor who was able to reflect the accents that occur within the book. So the main story obviously all occurs in Berkshire, but as you rightly said at the beginning, Jack is from Newcastle, and when his past starts catching up with him in the 1939 narrative, there is another character from the northeast who turns up and is able to identify untruths that Jack might have woven into his story from his accent. So it was very important to me that we managed to secure an actor who was able to, in their voice, reflect those different accents to reveal that aspect of the story. So yes, I heard Katie's reel and I thought that she would do a really good job of it. So yeah, definitely pleased that Katie was on board.
Tommy boy, the war is over. Nora grabs Tom under his armpits. Screeching, she whirls him round and around until he is flying like one of his beloved Spitfires. He giggles with delight, a smile splitting his cheeks, but it fails to mask the hint of uncertainty that lurks behind it. Gwen does not engage with their joyful exuberance. Instead, she drifts forward, the significance of the tumbling bells weighing heavily on her thoughts. The war is over.
Oh, Gwen!
She gasps as Nora wraps her in an unexpected embrace, rocking her from side to side and squeezing her so tightly she can barely breathe. Released, she stumbles.
Our boys will be coming home at last,
Nora cries. She whips back to Tom.
Tom, your daddy is coming home!
Tom jumps up and down, matching Nora's ecstatic cheers with his own, but Gwen can tell he doesn't fully understand. How can he? Nora is fueling his excitement for a man he has never met. A man who, for him, fails to exist beyond the grey and white photograph that sits on the mantelpiece at home. How can he possibly comprehend his father's return? And she alone knows he has no need to, because Jack Ellison won't be coming home.
Katie Sobey narrating The Return, written by my guest, Anita Frank.
So I'm guessing that you're already hard at work on your third novel. Can you give us a little bit of a taste for what you have?
I am working on my third novel. I'm always slightly hesitant about saying too much in case it doesn't turn into my third novel, because I'm one of these people who gets the wobbles halfway through. But it's very different. It's going back in time. So this one is set just after the First World War, and it's a dark little story of revenge at the moment. That's all I'm going to say on it. But yeah, it's something very different again.
So a bit of a return to the kind of territory of your first novel.
Yeah, so my debut was a ghost story set during the First World War. And this one certainly has, it's not a ghost story. There is no sort of supernatural elements, but it draws on the history of the First World War in a similar sort of way that The Lost Ones did. Yeah.
And I know that in addition to your writing, you are also a full-time carer for your son.
I am indeed, yes. So I'm blessed with three children, but my youngest child, my little boy, who's not so little now, he's 17, but he is severely mentally disabled with a rare form of epilepsy. So yes, he requires full-time care. Luckily, he's physically absolutely fine, but mentally he's about 6 months. So he's got no form of communication or understanding, and he needs full personal care and so on. So he's an absolute joy, and he brings us a great deal of happiness. He can be hard work, and he does interrupt the writing process quite often, I have to say, but he's an absolute joy to have.
It must mean that you are a very disciplined writer, just grabbing the moments when you can, and presumably a great jotter down of notes.
Oh gosh, disciplined I think is quite flattering. I'm not sure I am a disciplined writer. I do grab the time when I can, because he goes to school, but his attendance is not 9 to 3. It tends to be a bit more haphazard than that, depending when he wants to get up in the morning. So yes, I do try and get him off to school and then work through the day while he's not with me, obviously. When he's around, there are certain things that I can do. I find I can do things like editing when he's around, but it's a bit more challenging to create something from scratch when he's pottering about as well. But yeah, I do tend to write constantly in my head and, like you say, jot down notes through the day as well. So I'm always thinking. I think that's the key thing. I'm always thinking about the story that I'm working on, whether I'm looking after Jack or washing up or cooking the dinner or whatever. There's always a thought process going on. Bits of dialogue come to me, or if there's a knotty plot problem, I will be thinking about that while I'm walking the dog. So it's always living and evolving in my head, even if I'm not sat in front of the laptop necessarily resolving those issues into words which will hit the page later.
Anita Frank, thank you so much for sharing some of your writing time with the Read On listeners and for giving us greater insight into The Return. And I hope that you'll return at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Thanks to the generous support of HarperCollins, both The Return and The Lost Ones are available from the RNIB Library. And Anita Frank will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we'll discover how a talking book narrator used her experience to bring pictures to life through audio description. But first, Kate Lunton is an old friend of the show. The former Metropolitan Police officer was one of the first guests that I interviewed when I joined Read On 5 years ago. Back then, we were discussing her breathtaking debut, Postmortem, which was recently adapted as ITV Drama of the Week, The Tower. Following its success, I know I'm not the only one hoping that its sequel, Death Message, will also be coming to our TV screens. But if you can't wait that long and want to know what happens next, the audiobook version of Postmortem is available from the RNIB Library.
The Great Storm of 1987 was the before and after of Claire Mills's life. More than 20 years later, she still woke in the middle of the night with a sudden ice-cold alarm that had her sitting up and seeing with luminous clarity those uprooted trees and crushed vehicles. The terror in her heart in the lonely hours of the morning was always the same, that the smaller traces of disaster in her life that she had chosen to ignore for so long had, on the morning after the storm, been emphatically written on the landscape, crying out for her to notice them at last. Among the many, many reproaches she made to herself was this one. She had failed to pay attention to portents.
Antonia Beamish narrating Postmortem by Kate Lunton, who joined me in the studio. Kate, welcome back.
It's a pleasure.
I get the impression that you chose the title equally deliberately as you chose Postmortem. Could you tell us exactly what the title Death Message refers to?
Well, in police talk, death message is when you have to tell the next of kin that somebody has died. It's usually a memorable experience to go to somebody's house and tell them that unexpectedly somebody they love has died. And I think the sort of pun, as there was a pun on Postmortem, is I suppose it's a book about living for the two main protagonists, Sarah and Lizzie.
And that image of the trees uprooted by violence by the storm in 1987 that the book starts with is one that resonates throughout the book. The fact that the detectives are investigating skeletal remains that have been unearthed by violent acts. And I think you at one point say, you know, Sarah Collins sees her job as giving the anonymous victims of London their importance back.
She had thought that she could represent small people against the sort of tide of indifference, and she's standing by the Thames when she thinks this, and that after the experience of Postmortem that she feels less confident of that, shaken. And I think that the two characters, Lizzie and Collins, are both uprooted by what's happened in the novel before. So you have obviously the turned earth after the storm and the fact that a girl is missing and that that family is constantly uprooted and never able to settle, but also that the two main protagonists are in a similar state.
Yes, that they actually have to assume the grief of the friends and relatives of the missing or murdered victims that they're looking into.
Yes, and I think you see with Lizzie that she's resistant, that she doesn't want to get involved in the people that she's tasked with investigating and so on. She resists it, but she becomes, you know, more and more involved. So I suppose it's quite a redemptive novel in a way for the two female protagonists.
I certainly hadn't realised that murder investigation teams investigate two cases concurrently, that there's a cold case and an active case. Is that standard procedure within the Met?
Yes, major investigation teams, MIT teams, will have any number of investigations running at any particular time. They have a period, which is in the book, which was when they're on call for 7 days, where they will respond to live incidents. So somebody who's likely to die, a high-risk missing person, or a murder, or indeed a manslaughter. But then they will also have ongoing cases, and they will have cold case reviews, historic cases that come back up, that they will review the evidence. And I think one of the brilliant things is that an undetected murder isn't closed in the Met. It's looked at on a regular basis in case there are leads that can lead to detecting it.
So I know that you don't take actual cases and write about them, but the reinvestigation of somebody who disappeared in 1987 and whose body has never been found is something perfectly plausible for a MIT team to be looking into.
Yes, absolutely. So a case like that would be reviewed if the person was believed to have come to harm, and if there was any new evidence, resources would be put into it. And if you Google cold cases or historic cases, you will find that the Met does get detections for them, and that they're always a cause for celebration, that even though they often bring bad news and they turn the earth, as it were, of the experiences of the next of kin, at the same time they do bring resolution for people.
Yes, I thought you handled that very sensitively and very thought-provokingly, that I know one of the detectives asked herself, what would we be wishing for if this girl were still to be alive? She would have been imprisoned, she would have had awful things done to her.
I think one of the things about people who are missing is that the families worry so very much where they are and what's happening to them, and that there's something desperate about that open question. And so resolution is helpful.
And as you said, both your detectives are moving on from post-mortem, and that's in very stark contrast to the mother of the missing girl, who is caught in this kind of stasis. But both your detectives are just moving on to the next traumatic incident. You say there's a redemption at the end of the novel, but both of them have been put through the ringer again. You don't pull any punches about how traumatic and difficult policing in 21st century London can be.
Well, it's interesting because the book's just been serialised, and I've had brilliant readership who've been incredibly responsive and warm and involved. But one of the things they've talked about is how hard policing is. But I think that is partly a product of this particular book, where these two women are really in a state of trying to resolve how they feel about their job and whether they can continue to do their job after the experiences of the last book. And I think that when you do it, it isn't like that all the time. And also there's an enormous joy and pleasure in policing, which probably doesn't come across in this book because that isn't what this book's about. But there's an enormous satisfaction in delivering justice for people.
It's certainly something that I think comes out in the squad room humour that you have, such as when the team gather together to investigate the current murder.
The duty inspector had rounded up CID from all over the Nick, and the drinks machine shuddered loudly as it dispensed Coke and Red Bull. Ash had celebrated the news by bringing the biscuit tin from the office to the canteen, and everyone was digging in, the tin rapidly emptying.
I'm a rebel, me,
he said in a fake northern accent. Can't wait to see the DI's face in the morning when all the biscuits have gone. Do you think she'll put a crime report on? An officer, in the act of stuffing two biscuits in his mouth at the same time, said, You're fine, mate. No witnesses. The duty inspector walked briskly into the canteen and sat at one of the tables.
When you're ready.
They gathered round, mostly standing. She handed out the hastily printed briefing sheets.
With the station Grapevine fully operational, I expect most of you will already know what this is about.
Lizzie was staring at the briefing. At the top was a custody image of a white male, round head, short cropped hair, QPR shirt. It was the most recent image, taken the last time he'd been nicked.
As a woman who served in the Metropolitan Police for several years, do you think that women bring a different perspective to detection?
What I'd say more is that you need a mix of people. It isn't necessarily to do with whether they're male or female, but different experiences, different attitudes. You know, there's the guy who can sit there with the spreadsheet and just concentrate on the spreadsheet all day, and that is very important detective work, but it isn't for everybody. And then there's the guy who can go along and talk to the guy who's fencing stolen goods and persuade him to talk to him. And again, that's a different skill. Not everybody's going to have that skill. And there's the person who can go, not necessarily a woman. I went with a brilliant man in his 50s once to deliver a death message, and he was so fantastic at being there and listening and saying the right thing and not saying too much. So I think it's more that you really need a big range of personalities and people.
Clearly, the delivering of death messages must have affected you quite deeply. I mean, you certainly bring the detective's eye for detail to the minutiae of how relatives react and how they slowly crumple or they slowly put up walls and how it's not a static state.
Yes, and everybody's different and everyone is surprising. You know, it isn't what you expected. It isn't the same every time. Yes, they stay with you, definitely.
I think one of the fascinating aspects of the book is having the two female protagonists.
And of course, Fat Elaine now.
And Fat Elaine, who's a wonderful character and and coaxed away from the biscuit tin. But you give the three aspects of policing that Sarah Collins plays very much by the book. Lizzie is rather instinctive. And both of them have aspects of those two vital areas of detection, but in different measure. Was it something you felt very much was a struggle between those aspects of detection whilst you were looking into cases?
There are people who have an incredibly good nose. They call it a copper's nose. And the Met has this award every year, Best Thief Taker, which is controversial and some people don't like it. But there was a PC on my ground who was extraordinary how he would bring arrests in. Good arrests, you know, how he would know. And you would look at him and think, how do you know? I used to think he was like a one-man ANPR system, that he must sit on the tube and go ping, ping, ping. So it definitely exists, this instinct, but it needs to be balanced up. And again, I think that comes across in the book, where the DCI is much more certain that if somebody's a wrong'un, that they've done the crime.
Mm.
But then again, he's got a point.
And also, it can drag you up blind alleys. It can.
That's right. And people can get fixated on a suspect and they follow that person and follow and put a lot of resources into that person. And we know there are famous cases where this has happened and the other person quietly slips away.
Mm. Which I suppose is why these cold case reviews are so useful, to bring a fresh pair of eyes to a case.
Yes. And of course, technology moves on. And that's the other thing that catches up with some people, is that they didn't realise that they were leaving DNA behind because it hadn't been so prevalent.
And one of the other senses of loss that comes through the book is for a time past, a time that actually isn't in the so distant past, 1987, but which represents a country where things were done differently, you know,
yes.
where cardboard boxes were rigid. And where you had physical photographs.
Yes, and carbon copies of things. And people didn't routinely use computers. And telephone codes were different. And you lived through the time, if you're my age, you were alive during the Great Storm. But the past is a different country. It's the question of how much we change. And I suppose that's relevant to Sarah Collins in it, because there's a lot of Sarah Collins' backstory in explaining who she is and where she is and what she needs to do in order to become more fully herself.
And there's also the question of how policing has changed in those years. I mean, I was a great fan of The Sweeney, and we've had programmes like Ashes to Ashes on the television, which show a rougher, tougher police force. And yet the police force of 2014, 2015 in Death Message seem almost constrained by the justice system. It's almost as if they're in a bare-knuckle fight asking to play by Queensbury rules.
I mean, I think the police themselves talk about pre-PACE, which is a piece of legislation, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, and post-PACE, and they're very different worlds, because there's much more limits now, limits on detention, how long you can keep people in, very strict identification procedures, very strict rules about interviews and what's admissible. And it's a much better world, and the quality of evidence is much better, I think. But I think, yes, of course, that's coupled up with a worry that sometimes the police feel they can't do their jobs. I mean, there's a huge issue at the moment, I think, in London about pursuits, that the police are very frightened and unwilling, and I believe don't very much pursue mopeds anymore. And yet we know that a lot of serious crime, robbery and so on, is moped-enabled. It's very difficult. You've got to care about the people on the bikes and that they don't die, but you've also got to care about the victims of crime. And it's, I think it's very hard to balance up those two things. And in the middle of it, I think police officers get caught up and they don't know how to do their job. They feel damned if they do and damned if they don't, with serious consequences.
But I suppose in that you're also removing the loopholes whereby people can slip out of a conviction.
It's really complicated and I don't have the answers. But I think also another thing that you're having is that there was a time when police could go to an incident and think, it's not really a good idea for these people to get arrested. The best thing is for us to sort it out, get them to say sorry to each other and move on. That was problematic because domestic violence perpetrators weren't arrested and so on. And people who needed to be arrested weren't arrested. But there is another side of the spectrum where sometimes it is better to show discretion. And I think that police are more and more frightened to show discretion and that perhaps people are arrested and cautioned inappropriately. At the end of the day, society needs to give clearer guidance to police what exactly they want. Because at the same time, they can go on being furious that somebody hasn't been prosecuted for an offence or outraged that somebody's been arrested for an offence. It's very difficult.
I certainly came away feeling that I had a better view of the police and the job that they did, and realising that the portrayals that we get on television are rather two-dimensional.
The thing that drives me insane is when people think that policing is really simple and why don't people just do it properly? Peter Hitchens is very keen in his columns to say that it's straightforward and that the police should simply do this. It is a difficult job. It is a challenging job. It has all sorts of people working in it. I think that makes for good stories.
The ITV crime drama The Tower is still available to watch on Catch Up. And all three books in Kate London's Collins and Griffiths series are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Anita Frank to hear the books of her life, when I stopped being able to see the TV screen, I gave up watching telly, which may have helped me listen to more audiobooks, but did little to stop me feeling isolated from day-to-day life. That was until I discovered audio description, which allows me to enjoy series like The Tower and then discuss it with sighted friends and family. Di Langford is the doyen of audio description. She's been enhancing TV shows, film, theatre and opera for visually impaired audience members since AD first started. And it all began because she was an RNIB Talking Books narrator, a job she still loves doing, as I found out when she joined me in the studio. Di Langford, welcome to Read On.
A pleasure.
So I was looking through the list of books that you've recorded for the RNIB Talking Books Library, and it's enormous. It's 115, I think, at most recent count.
I think I've lost count by now.
How did you start?
Well, a friend who'd come for an audition once, he's South African, and they wanted someone who could do all those sort of clicky accents. And after he'd done the audition, he rang me up and he said, hey, by the way, they need somebody who can do Welsh, so could you just get in touch with them? So I came along, and the first book I was asked to read, it was called The Women of Llangollen. And it actually turned out to be two Irish women who'd moved to Llangollen. Now, I don't speak Welsh. I was born in Cardiff, but I can pronounce the names of towns, which is all I really had to do in that book. And I think that is the only Welsh book I've ever read in all those years.
But you seem to have covered the globe. I noticed you've done an awful lot of books about China, including a biography of Chairman Mao.
Well, I think that was about 19 hours recorded listening. It took us longer than that to record it, but to listen to it, it would take you 19 hours. That was hard going, because he was a monster. And the reason I think I got involved with Chinese books is because I was quite good at sight reading, phonetics. And when we first started doing books here, somebody who knew about languages would go through the books in advance, check out anything they thought needed pronunciation, and then write it out in phonetics, which I happened to do at drama school. Nowadays, we have to do that ourselves. And then once I'd had one Chinese one and it seemed okay, I kept getting more, which was fine.
Well, one of my favourites, the book I thoroughly enjoyed, is called All the Tea in China, all about a Scotsman, a botanist who was sent over to, well, steal tea plants to transport them to India.
Yes, that's extraordinary, isn't it? I read that book and it's amazing how that happened, that we think we know all about it and there are all these stories behind that nobody knows anything about.
For 2 weeks, he had been confined on a listless junk near the city of Fuzhou, at the mouth of the Min River. His ordinarily robust constitution was near collapse. With a raging fever, he took to his bunk in the cabin of a seagoing cargo boat, dizzy from the smell of bilge water and rotting fish. The junk's deck was laden with timber from the countryside. Also on deck was Fortune's cargo, which included trunk-sized glass boxes filled with flowers, shrubs, grasses, vegetables, fruits, and all manner of exotic plant life. These glazed cases, known as Wardian or Ward's cases after their inventor, were on their way with Fortune to London, if he ever made it that far. With his long legs dangling off a bunk made for shorter Chinese men, Fortune, only 33 years old at the time, imagined himself dying in the boat's hold, being swaddled in his grimy bedclothes, then unceremoniously hurled overboard. A watery grave in China would be the end of him.
My guest, Di Langford, reading All the Tea in China. So you haven't only read biographies and histories. There's a huge number of classic crime books, such as those by Ellis Peters, to your name, and quite a lot of historical romances. Do you have a favourite genre that you enjoy reading?
No, not particularly. I really enjoy reading them all because they're books that I would never read myself, probably. Lots of romantic sagas, family sagas, a lot of them set in South Wales, which is, of course, where I come from. So those are interesting, but I don't have a particular favourite at all.
You've done a lot of children's books as well, including all the Mallory Towers books, which
yes,
I know my daughters thoroughly enjoyed.
Those were fun.
And Carrie's War.
Yes.
Now, I noticed that you've actually done three or four of Nina Borden's books, including a rather moving tribute to her husband who was killed in the Potter's Bar train crash.
Yes, yes, that's right. That was very moving.
Do you have a particular affinity with her writing? Is that why you've been asked to do so many of her books?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure how each particular reader is chosen.
And how do you go about preparing to narrate a talking book?
Well, I read it. And as I'm going through, I make a note, particularly there's a lot of dialogue, of who's speaking. So I'll just put an initial. So if it's Norman, I'll just put N next to it. And if it's Mary, I'll put M next to that bit of dialogue so that you can sort of sight read it as you go. And that's it, really. Just getting familiar with the characters, not acting it out, using perhaps a slightly deeper voice for a man or a lighter voice for a woman. Obviously, if you know that someone is Welsh or perhaps Scottish, you won't overdo that, but make an attempt at those accents.
And will you read the book once or twice?
Yes, definitely. And if it's a very complicated one, then more than once.
And, of course, your work as an audiobook narrator has fed directly into another career as an audio describer for stage, TV and film.
Yes, yes, that's right.
How did that come about?
Well, the RNIB began by deciding that they were going to describe films. And what would happen there would be that the description would be recorded onto the soundtrack of the film, which would then be available on VHS, which could be borrowed or rented from the RNIB or could be bought from the RNIB. The RNIB asked some of the talking book readers to audition to be audio describers, and four of us were chosen to do it. And we started off, and really, we made it up as we went along, because nothing had been done like that before. And so we just did what we could, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And now, most of the big film companies are including audio description on their DVDs, but when we were doing it, it was only done on VHS.
That indicates that it was sometime back in the 1990s then?
It was a long time ago, yes, it was.
And do you remember the first films or series that you worked on?
I do remember the very first book that I narrated was written by one of the other describers, and we were so keen to get it right that I actually went to his house and we rehearsed it before we got into the studio. And in those days, when we were actually doing the descriptions, we worked in recording studios in Soho, which were provided for us by the film companies.
And how many times would you watch a film or a play before you would set down the script that you're going to audio describe it from?
When it was a film, you'd have it on VHS or DVD, and so you just play it backwards and forwards, depending. If you're doing something like Braveheart, there's lots of horse battles, so you have to go over and over and over again, picking out which is the most important person in that particular scene. With a play, we'll go to see it once, and then we'll be provided with a DVD of the actual performance, which we can then work on at home. And again, depending on the action, that will depend on how often you look at it. If there are dances, for instance, you keep having to go backwards and forwards, working out the dance routine. Whereas if it's mainly dialogue, just people coming in and out of a room or maybe even sitting down, just those very simple actions, that doesn't take as long to do. It's the physical stuff, lots of fighting or battles or dance routines particularly take quite a long time.
I often wonder how you fit quite so much information into four or five words, because you've got a necessarily very small window of opportunity. Do you find yourself crafting the same short sentences again and again to cut down the number of syllables?
Yes, the description part is easy. The hard part is cutting it down to fit into the space available, because we don't talk over dialogue. Or if you're doing opera, for instance, we don't talk over significant music or any sort of mood sounds. So, yeah, definitely.
Now, one of your first jobs was working on the Harry Potter films.
Yes, that's right.
And you audio described all of them?
I did.
And I believe that for some time, the audio descriptions of the first three weren't actually available with the DVD box set.
Apparently, that's what happened. Since then, I get some idea that they are now available. I'm still trying to find out, because I would like to get a box set of all of them. At the moment, I've got five of them on DVD with my voice on, and the first three are still on VHS.
It strikes me that it's probably a very different discipline to be an audio describer to being a talking book narrator, because presumably you have to watch the film or the programme and then write yourself a script as to what you're going to describe.
Yes, that's right. So the film company would provide us with a script which had a time code on it, which would be the cue. We could use that for setting ourselves cues for when we were going to include our description.
Do you have a motto to remind yourself of how to do the best job as an audio describer? Is there a secret?
A motto? Oh. I suppose telling the story is a good one, because often there are so many things when you're looking at a screen and there are lots and lots of things going on, and you've got to prioritise what's important in this scene and what is going to help the person who's not able to actually see it understand what's happening. Where are the important places? If I'm focusing as a viewer, how can I help my listener to also focus on the action happening on the screen?
I was wondering, do you ever close your eyes and watch the film with your ears and then think, oh, what's that sound? I need to describe that.
I used to do that. I don't do it as much now, but every so often that will happen. If there's something happening, there's a lot going on, if you do listen, you can hear particular sounds. And what I've also become aware of, when I've perhaps sat with someone who is sighted and is listening to an audio description, afterwards they might say, well, that wasn't in any way intrusive, and it actually made me aware of things I would never have noticed before.
I think the best audio description is very inobtrusive and actually rather minimalist. If there's too much audio description, sometimes I don't focus on what's happening. I'm just trying to gather everything around it.
Yes.
It's a bit of a muddle.
That's right.
Do you find that you have to use a different voice as an audio describer to that of a narrator, that it can't be as expressive, maybe?
It depends. I think, for instance, if you're doing a film, I don't do films as much now, I do plays, but certainly when we were doing films, that if you had a battle scene, your voice is obviously going to have more energy in it than if you were doing a romantic love scene. So I think, yes, that you would go with the mood, really, of the scene without over-dramatising, because a lot of audio describers have been actors, or still are actors, in fact, and so you have to be careful that you don't want to be one of the performers in the production. You're a voice in someone's ear who's just helping them make sense of what's going on.
Yes, you're enhancing the performance rather than leading the audience member through it.
Yes, yes, that's a good way of putting it.
So, if I could offer you any film or stage play to audio describe, which one would you push all the other AD narrators out of the way for?
Wow, it's hard to say, because everyone I do is different. For instance, I'm doing, at the moment, plays, not films. And so I'm doing the Harry Potter plays in the West End. I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof. I've just done a play at the Bush, which is in a very small space, much more intimate there. So each one is an adventure. So I'm not going to choose one. I'm just going to enjoy them all.
How about a book to be a talking book narrator of then?
Again, this is exactly the same. I really, really enjoy every book that I read. It's a pleasure to do them. I really enjoy them.
Well, there you go. Not talking yourself out of any future work. I think that's a very diplomatic answer. Di Langford, thank you so much for being the voice in my ears for so many wonderful books and making my enjoyment of TV and film as a blind person far greater over the last few years.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For a full list of the scores of books that Di Langford has narrated for the RNIB Library, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Anita Frank for the books of her life. Anita, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure it'll come as no surprise when I say it's an Enid Blyton book. So for me, it could be any of her books, in all honesty. But the one that really had a huge impact on me was The Children of Cherry Tree Farm. And I read that over and over again and absolutely inhaled anything that Enid Blyton wrote as a child. So I loved all of her work, but definitely she was the one that put imagination into my head, I think. So yes, thank you, Enid Blyton.
Oh, Penny, it's too good to be true, said Benji. No school, just going wild in the country. I'd like to go wild. I wish I could go down the rabbit holes and live wild there. I wish I could get into a hollow tree and live wild there. I wish... Benji, don't be silly. It will be much nicer to live at Cherry Tree Farm with Auntie Bess and Uncle Tim, said Rory. Golly, cream every day. And those apple pies with cheese that Auntie Bess makes. And strawberries straight out of the garden.
Abigail Hardiman narrating The Cherry Tree Farm Story Collection by Enid Blyton, which is available commercially.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, again, a bit of a classic, but I think Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, for me, I've read it numerous times and I still roar with laughter at the wonderful Mrs. Bennet lines that come out, or Liz's father telling her that he will never speak to her again if she does marry Mr. Collins. So I do adore Pride and Prejudice, definitely, and that's one that I get pleasure out of every time I return to it.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters.
"My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day. "Have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. "Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it." This was invitation enough.
Emilia Fox narrating Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, it's a book by a friend of mine, actually, but I'm going to sing its praises because it's a wonderful book. It's called Boys Don't Cry by Fiona Scarlett, who's an Irish debut author, and it is the most beautifully produced book. It's quite short. It's about two brothers who are growing up in quite a rough area of Dublin, and it's how the oldest brother is trying desperately to protect his younger one from the harsh aspects of life that surround them in their environment. Their father is on the edge of a crime network, and he's trying his best to show his young brother that there are other paths available to them in life. But when his brother becomes ill, life becomes a lot more difficult for both of them. And it's, as I say, quite a brief book, but I defy anybody not to be in tears by the final page. It's beautifully written and beautifully done. So that's Boys Don't Cry by Fiona Scarlett.
It was supposed to be a garden. Well, according to that anyway. And there was a remnant of a burnt out bench to prove his point. But I was glad the council got bored and decided to leave it as it is. You wouldn't get much football done in a garden. And the wheels of your scooter wouldn't roll, and you'd probably get L1s just sitting in it, looking at stuff. Nah, I much preferred it as it was, all concrete and gated. Kept it just for us. Penals? Dunner asked, while taking 12 steps away from goal, trying to mark a spot in the cracking pavement with his heel. Not beyond here, or I'll call chi, he warned. And a Dunner warning was enough. Not that he'd do anything, mind you, but he was such a moanhole that he'd go on and on about it for ages and drive us all demented. Right, so who's goalie? I asked. Folded my arms determinately. No way was I going in again.
Ronan Raftery narrating Boys Don't Cry by Fiona Scarlett, which is available commercially.
Anita Frank, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Well, it's been an absolute joy to be with you, so thank you ever so much for having me on.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.